You are listening to Pastor Talk.
And the reason why end times discipleship doesn't work is because eschatology, which is generally, Barty's right, that's the study of the
last
end times.
Days, really.
Right, last right, days. Yeah. But eschatology in a broader sense means the entire way that you view the movement and trajectory of history.
Okay.
So there is eschatology, for example, in other religions.
Yes.
And in even, you could say in secular thinking, mm-hmm. there is an eschatology, a vision of the future where you see the world headed. So I'm using eschatology in that broad sense.
Welcome to Pastor Talk, the podcast of Lifeway Pastors, giving you the tools and encouragement you need to shepherd your flock well. I'm your host, Marty Duren.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome back to Pastor Talk. This is your host, Marty Duren. And today I have not only a leading author and important person, he's also a friend, Trevin Wax, PhD.
Marty, that was so nice of you.
He asked me to say that. From Southeastern Baptist Seminary, is the Bible and Reference Publisher for Lifeway Christian Resources. Many of you probably know him by his blog, Kingdom People. Is that the acronym?
Yes.
TrevinWax.com. Welcome.
Glad to be back on.
It's good to have you. He says back on because he was on like episode 6 or something like that.
We did a round table on writing.
With Barnabas and Chris, I think.
Yes, that's right.
So for the three people who are listening who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about Trevin K. Wax.
You said the three people who are listening. I was like, wait, how many people listen to this podcast? I'm just kidding. So I oversee the Bible and reference side of Lifeway. So that includes our publishing, the Bibles we publish, reference books, commentaries, things like that, as well as what we carry in our stores on Lifeway.com, the whole Bible business, so to speak, that part of Lifeway's ministry. And I'm a teaching pastor at my church, graduate at Southeastern Seminary.
Teach every Sunday, 3 times a month? What's the rotation?
40 weeks a year.
40 weeks,
so
okay.
I guess it works out to 3 times a month, but I
usually... You're like an average church member.
That's about right. Yeah, I wish all of our average church members came 3 times a month nowadays, but yeah, that's about it, right?
Okay. You were a missionary for a couple years?
Several years, lived in Romania.
And brought home a wife.
That's right. We got married there, had our first son there. We lived there quite a while before I brought her home.
I did not. Okay. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. And we still speak Romanian at home. So.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Anybody that wants to come in and listen on our private conversations better have a translator.
Yeah. Good luck.
So,
KGB probably listening to you.
That's right.
Okay. So you've written several books. Your latest, though, is an academic volume, Eschatological Discipleship.
Yes.
Can we just call it End Times Discipleship?
No.
The subtitle, Leading Christians to Understand Their Historical and Cultural Context. That's a mouthful, dude.
That's right. It's an academic book. It's supposed to be that way, right?
Oh, well, I don't know. I will tell you that I'm really disappointed about one thing, because you know the first thing I did when I picked up this book?
You looked at the index?
I looked at the name index.
You're seeing if I quoted you?
Yeah, I am. Guess what?
I didn't quote you. It was an academic book, Marty.
I got a blog.
That's true. You do. I'm not one to denigrate blogs.
And
hear
just,
me out.
And just to let our listeners know, he quoted Richard Dawkins, famed atheist, and I couldn't find my way into the book. So,
well, Richard Dawkins
bitter,
is a colorful writer.
I'm not bitter.
Okay, no, obviously not.
Not the least. So, Eschatological Discipleship. So this is a reboot of Left Behind series, right?
No. Okay. No. And the reason why End Times Discipleship doesn't work is because eschatology, which is generally, Barty's right, that's the study of the
last
end times.
Last days, really.
Right, last days. Yeah. But eschatology in a broader sense means the entire way that you view the movement and trajectory of history.
Okay.
So there is eschatology, for example, in other religions.
Yes.
And in even, you could say in secular thinking, mm-hmm. there is an eschatology, a vision of the future where you see the world headed. So I'm using eschatology in that broad sense.
Is it kind of a worldview? Is it related to the way a person would view everything? I mean, I know that word's
yes.
kind of going out of vogue a little bit, but...
No, it would, but it's a little bit, it's more narrow than worldview, because okay. worldview is the big picture. Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? What went wrong? All of those things are important. I write about that in the book some, and when we get into some worldview discussions. But with a lot of different worldviews that are out there, eschatology, where the world is headed, is a major component of
sure.
those worldviews.
Okay, yeah.
And so what I'm trying to do is say it is in Christianity too,
yeah.
and it actually affects our discipleship.
Okay. How so?
So the worldview question that eschatology deals with is the question of what time is it? So think of it this way. If you're a missionary to a different culture or to a different place, cross-cultural missionary, you go somewhere. Most of the time when you're on mission somewhere, you realize, okay, what biblical faithfulness is going to look like is going to differ somewhat based on the place, the your location,
right?
Not the major commands of Scripture, the sort of the non-negotiables, but how that's worked out in a given culture. We all have that sense that, okay, this, you know, faithfulness may take on different shapes and forms based on the culture that you're in.
Okay.
I'm making the case that that's also true of time. That time, the moment, the cultural moment in which we find ourselves will influence and impact our understanding of discipleship and the way that we make disciples.
Okay, so it's not just the culture, it's the specific moment that you're in the culture.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Because, and the reason is because, so to give an example that's not in the book, but something I've been thinking about the last couple of weeks, I heard some church leaders discussing this. Think about the great...
Was it me?
No, I'm sorry. We haven't gotten together in a while.
That's true. I work every day.
Yeah, me too. That's why.
So you're listening to some church leaders?
Yeah. So some church leaders were talking about, okay, so take the catechisms, the classic catechisms that we have in the Protestant tradition.
Okay.
The Westminster Catechism or the Heidelberg Catechism or the, you know, Charles Spurgeon's Catechism. Those catechisms, if you really look at them, as beautiful a summary of Christian teaching in a lot of ways as they are meant to be very Protestant. Mm-hmm. To show the distinction between these beliefs versus Roman Catholicism.
Right.
Why? Because in the cultural moment that they were in, when they were catechizing their young people, when they were discipling via the catechism, they were showing how their understanding of Christianity was a contrast to what they saw as false. So to apply that to today, if we're going to catechize, disciple, pass the torch, to the next generation, pass on our faith. We have got to have the same mindset. I'm not saying we have to do a catechism.
Sure.
But we have to do the same mindset to say, okay, where are the elements where we need to show in this day and age, Christianity is different?
Mm-hmm.
How does it stand out? And you really don't get that unless you're asking the what time is it question.
Okay.
What are the false worldviews that are swirling around? False views of history, false views of the future. What are those? And how does Christianity, how do we raise up people to understand we live in contradistinction to those things?
So is an addendum to that thinking then that teaching your kids or your church, the Heidelberg Catechism, for instance, is good but insufficient because it doesn't speak to
today's
our time?
Some of it would. Okay. I mean, there's so much of those catechisms that are just beautifully beautiful statements of Christian truth. So I would not say that those are unhelpful in any way.
Well, that's good because I didn't say that either.
I know.
Are they incomplete based on our time?
Yes.
Okay.
Because they weren't built for our time.
Right.
So, and I'm not saying that we need a new catechism. What I'm saying is we've got to be intentional about identifying the prevailing cultural narratives of our day that are likely to impinge upon the Christian church and lead us to compromise our gospel or lead us to a sort of syncretism with our time. We have to be aware of those elements, and then we've got to be in our churches helping people understand Christian truth in all of its beauty.
Okay, so how do you recommend a church go about that if they're not going to do a new catechism?
Well, you do it in several ways. In the book, I'm unpacking where eschatological discipleship is in the Bible.
Okay.
So why Paul, for example, when he's commanding Christians to obey, he's doing that on the basis of what is going to be true of the future.
Mm-hmm.
So he does the past too, and the gospel-centered movement gets us really good. You know, we obey in light of what Jesus has done. Yes, but Paul a lot of times says, live this way because of what Jesus has promised in the future.
Right.
Right. So first I'm doing that with the Bible. Then I'm showing what are some of the major eschatologies of our day? I'm talking primarily about the Enlightenment, the sexual revolution, and consumerism.
Okay.
Consumerism's the hardest in there because that one is the one I mean, that is literally, that is the air we breathe, the culture, the waters we swim in. So I talk about that. But then by the end of the book, I give some recommendations as to different understandings of discipleship and how they work out in the local church based on what kind of congregation you're in or what stream of evangelicalism that you might be in. And in that, I'm saying, okay, without taking a position on which of these visions of discipleship should you be, you know, gung-ho about, right. my point at the end is to say, here are some ways that no matter what your church is doing when it comes to making disciples, mm-hmm. whether you kind of conceive of discipleship more in spiritual disciplines, Dallas Willard kind of terms, mm-hmm. or whether it's more like, if, you know, evangelists making disciples who make disciples, mm-hmm. kind of the Liberty University kind of an evangelistic model, where it's more, whether it's more gospel-centered. My point isn't to say this is the only way. My point is to come along and say each of these models would be significantly strengthened if there was that element of what time is it? Mm-hmm. So there's that countercultural motif, that countercultural pull that is involved in that.
I've opened your, I haven't read it to be completely open.
Neither has my wife. So neither has many people that love me, Marty. So not holding it against you.
Thank you very much. I said that because of the two times that I've opened it recently, both times it went to the page that's talking about the movie Pleasantville, which I haven't seen, but I'm familiar with it. And you use it as, I don't know if the metaphor is the right word or not, but the movie itself is a metaphor.
Yes.
And you're using it to teach a little bit about what you see as problematic with the movie itself. How does Pleasantville relate to what you're teaching in the larger scope of eschatological discipleship?
Well, if you like flip a page, you'll get the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Just one.
Which that's a fun one. So yeah, I think somewhere on there I'm talking about Mary Tyler Moore.
I
so
see it.
This is probably the only like theology academic book that's gonna have references to Lucille Ball and Pleasantville in it. But
I don't know. Michael Bird might take exception.
True. And he endorsed it.
I saw that.
So Pleasantville is a great example. I use it because it's one. It's really, and I've seen other people use this, it's a classic example of a reverse fall narrative, mm-hmm. to where in the movie Pleasantville is about these 90s kids that travel back to the 1950s world of black and white, sanitized television, Leave It to Beaver kind of a mindset. Mm-hmm. And the town comes alive, comes awake, turns into color, basically, mm-hmm. by having sexual awakenings.
Okay.
Or by letting out their anger, right? So anything, whatever that irrepressible feeling or desire that is welling up from the real you inside rather than what's being repressed, mm-hmm. when that comes out, the world turns into color, right? So, and the reason I use that as an example in the book is because there's a clear eschatology there, right? That it's this understanding that the world is moving into a better, more inclusive, more holistic place as we express ourselves. It's that classic expressive individualist understanding of the world coming mm-hmm. out, and as we put aside traditional kind of morals and holding back our tempers and things that would things that basically would squelch our inner personhood.
Okay.
So Pleasantville is probably the most overt example mm-hmm. that I can find in film. You see that storyline in all sorts of things.
Yeah, we call it coming of age stories, typically.
Coming of age stories, or the world is going to be made new through, or that the way that you're charting the narrative. So using the Mary Tyler Moore Show as an example, I've read a biography about that show. The flap of on the jacket. One of the blurbs for it was, "This is the Mary Tyler Moore Show explains how we got from I Love Lucy to girls," right? Which Mary Tyler Moore was was appalled by girls, mm. right, before she died. That kind of sort of overly sexualized kind of understanding of, appalled by what television had become even in comedy.
And just as an aside, he's not talking about small females. He's talking about
the HBO
series
show,
Girls.
Yeah. Which I do not watch, and I'm not recommending.
Studied it.
Yeah, but I know of.
I'm sure.
I know of it, but what I.
So going from I Love Lucy to Girls is not about small females.
It's about emancipation.
Yes. Okay.
That's what the lady's saying.
Yeah.
And so the entire sexual revolution today is based on emancipation from repressive moral standards that actually harm us and endanger our dignity because we're not allowed to express who we are sexually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you realize, I mean, taken to a full extreme, I think marriage can't survive that, right? The understanding of marriage, and some would say it already hasn't because of, you know, right, easy divorce laws or same-sex marriage or whatever. But the idea of sexuality finding its proper place in a covenant union, mm-hmm. it not being essential to human flourishing because
we live together without being married.
That's what we'd say about marriage. But many people have the idea that sex is so essential to human flourishing that somehow to withhold sex from someone or to not is somehow to damage them, which then has given rise to this whole incel movement, mm-hmm. which I don't write about in the book because that's even newer than
the
book, that involuntary celibate, you know, males who are.
But they're mad about it.
They're mad.
They're not the biblical voluntary.
No.
They can't get a woman.
They've taken the logic, though, of the sexual revolution, which says everybody's entitled to sexual relationship and that it's essential to human flourishing, which is what the entire sexual revolution is really built on. Mm-hmm. And they've taken it to a dark place, right? A logical extreme, but obviously wrong.
And acting it out in violence.
That's right. The Toronto example recently. So this is a book. It's a little more academic. This Is Our Time is a much easier, more, I'd say, a pleasant read, I would think. This, though, is the underpinnings of that book, This Is Our Time. This is, if you want to go deeper with me into scripture, historical analysis, this is the place to go.
That sounds like a good podcast for you, Deeper with Trevin Wax. Trevin K. Wax, excuse me.
That's right. That's right.
So consumerism, you said just a minute ago that consumerism is the big one. So why is consumerism the big one? You said, I think it's the air we breathe, it's the water we swim in.
That's why it's the big one.
So explain why you...
It's the hardest part. It's the hardest part to write. I wrote a chapter on consumerism and This Is Our Time. By far the hardest I had to write. Could not get that chapter done without fasting and praying, literally.
Wow.
Because similar with the section on consumerism in this book, we are more of a consumer-minded consumer society where we quantify things, where we objectify, where we put prices on time and we put everything through the grid of consumeristic philosophy. Mm-hmm. We are more captive to that than I think we even know. And I know that it's true in our churches.
Elaborate on that a little bit for the pastors who are listening.
Yeah. So I asked our pastors this recently because we were talking about this. We were talking about getting our church, you know, like every pastor, we're talking about how do we make sure that our church has the mindset of mission, right? Mm-hmm. That we're sent out, that we're living missionally, and we don't have. I mean, because the classic example is kind of falling back onto the cruise ship model, mm-hmm. where people come into the church and they see it like it's basically a purveyor of spiritual goods and services, is the entertainment good? Is everyone happy? Is everyone pleased? And then everything's going smoothly, right? I've heard J.D. Greer talk about the difference between that. And then there's the battleship mentality, where, you know, you
always fighting.
But then there's the aircraft carrier, which he says is really the better vision, where it's the church is where we're actually launching people out into mission in different communities. It's not where mission happens is only at church. It's kind of out. Well, I was asking our pastor, so like what percentage of our congregation would be, I mean, basically cruise ship and I thought, you know, maybe 60-40, and the other pastor was like, oh no, it's like 80-20 cruise ship, right? And everybody was saying, and I even made clear, I don't think that's because any of us as pastors have done anything wrong,
right?
I just think that's the default expectation in church life because we live in a consumer society. So if we're going to do something different, we have to know we are swimming upstream against that.
Yeah.
Right? That idea. And this is one reason why so few American Christians. I think it's like 35% of American Christians believe attending religious services is essential to the faith, which means the majority of Christians, even those who go to church, see church attendance as optional. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, where does that come from? Well, because they look at it as something that's, if it's helpful, do it. If it's not, don't.
Right.
But the church is simply there to assist you in your individualized pursuit of the good life with Jesus tacked on.
Or making yourself better.
Making yourself better, yeah. Right. So when I say consumerism is the hardest one, it's because it is, it colors everything we do. Mm-hmm. And I'm not writing this book standing above it as if I'm saying, oh, I'm above the consumerist
sure.
impulse. You know, I recognize the tentacles of this and then how it gets into our church philosophy and into our understanding of discipleship. And then I did feel like I got some distance from it somewhat 5 years in Romania,
right.
which was at that time still pretty impoverished country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, villages, I lived in a village on weekends where we didn't have indoor plumbing, you know. So I feel like I got away from the culture and could kind of see it from the outside in. But the longer I've been back, the more
I've heard
air.
People say who were gone like you were for a number of years, especially if they were gone to a second world country or someplace
yes.
like
yeah.
that. Upon their return to the United States, they're just overwhelmed
yes.
with the volume of choices. So
yes.
going to Walmart, you know, is an anxiety producing event. It's not a convenience event
right.
for them. Because they're completely overwhelmed.
It's shocking.
Yeah.
It is shocking when you come back. Yeah.
That's really an odd thing to think about.
The very first time I came back from Romania, I mean, I was jet lagged, so I was a little stupid. When I got back after having been over there for months,
mm-hmm.
when I got back and we were walking into the parking lot from the Nashville airport and my parents had picked me up, I asked the question, when did they put a new car lot by the airport? And Dad looked at me and said, son, this is the parking lot. Because the cars and the vans and the were so pristine,
mm-hmm.
so new, so stunning mm-hmm. to me that I just assumed they're selling new cars over here by the, it's a car dealership over here by the airport. And that's because I had been in months with, I mean, old Dachas, that's the Romanian kind
yeah,
of car,
yeah.
where, you know, caked in mud and the smell of diesel and not, I mean, none of that. And hardly anyone, most people didn't even have a car. And like, it just rattled my mind to think all of those cars are just from normal people parking at the airport. So it's that kind of culture shock.
Well, if you'd have seen your old Honda there, wasn't
it's
a
Buick.
Honda? With 400,000 miles on it?
Oh, no, that was my Camry. Yeah.
You wouldn't have had that thought if you'd seen that thing.
No, that thing, I'm sure it's still running somewhere.
So this is a text, and I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here. Do you know any schools that are using it currently, and what classes are going to use this? What kinds of classes?
Yeah.
Because this is not like an eschatology textbook.
That's right. No, it's funny. I'm teaching at Wheaton this summer, and I'm not even using it. It's one of my textbooks. I should
That's
probably
good.
Not tell my academic. They'd like me to, I'm sure. So I don't know yet. I haven't heard of anyone who's assigned it yet.
Okay.
It's just now gotten out, and I'm starting to see some reviews come in for it. So I'll be interested to see. The academic team here has told me that they know of several professors who have said they're going to use
okay,
this book.
Okay, good.
But I don't know exactly which ones and where.
Now, has it officially dropped? I mean, this doesn't look like a galley copy that I have.
That's
it available?
Right. It's available now. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So it's Eschatological Discipleship. If you're a pastor, this is probably not the book for a Wednesday night study, but it might be a book for a staff study. I could easily see, especially if you have some good thinkers on your staff, that you would work through this together, you know, in a 3 months worth of staff meetings or something like that, to get an idea of some of the thoughts that Trevin's putting forth. But it does look interesting. I give Trevin a really hard time about everything all the time. But this really does look like a good book, so I would commend it to you. Anything you want to say as we wrap up?
I hope people enjoy it. It's meant to be kind of right next to This Is Our Time. So if I can sell two books
sure.
as a good consumer consumeristic mindset that
you
we are.
Confess that sin.
That's right. I this is our time is meant to be for people in your church.
Okay.
That you're if you're listening to some of this and you're wondering, man, how do I get people in my church engaged?
Mm-hmm.
That book is for that. This is more for the pastor and the staff, like you said, to give you some and I'm hoping it stirs up some thoughts and some different directions. So that it gets pastors and church leaders thinking about the way for us to be better and more faithful disciplers. That's what I'm hoping will happen.
Cool. My guest today on Pastor Talk has been Dr. Trevin K. Wax, author of Eschatological Discipleship, also the Bible and reference publisher for Lifeway Christian Resources. Thanks, Trevin, for being on Pastor Talk. If you have not yet followed Lifeway Pastors, on Twitter, it's at Lifeway Pastors. You're at Trevin Wax, correct? TrevinWax.
That's right.
On Twitter. And you probably have a Facebook page or something. You can search that if you'd like to. Until the next time, for Pastor Talk and for Lifeway Pastors, this is Marty Duren.
Pastor Talk is the podcast of Lifeway Pastors and is hosted by Marty Duren. That's me. Join us each week as I interview pastors, authors, professors, and others to help your ministry as you seek to shepherd your flock well. Until next time, this is Marty Duren.